Good morning. It's Wednesday, June 24th from HPR2. It's The Conversation. Is there such a thing as an unforgivable crime? If we refuse to forgive in the wake of last week's shootings in Charleston, do we damage something essential in ourselves? We'll talk with Father Walter Brownridge, Dean of the Cathedral of St. Andrew. And is the ongoing controversy over cane burning a collision between public health and the pursuit of profit? We'll look ahead to tomorrow's community forum in Kihei with Dr. Lauren Pang.
Yoga has been around for centuries, but can it help people with modern problems like body image, eating disorders, and stress management? We'll also hear from blues guitarist Rick Smith and go on a journey from the Mississippi Delta to Chicago's South Side, following the trail of muddy waters.
The conversation starts right after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Kathy.
Nice to get out of my usual morning routine.
It's good
be
to
here
have
on The
you.
Conversation.
Just sitting in for Beth Ann this week. We've got a topic of conversation that's been on a lot of people's minds in the past week. Some actions test our capacity to forgive, and few recent events have challenged that capacity, like the killing last week of 9 churchgoers in Charleston, South Carolina's Emmanuel African Methodist Church. Family members of the victims have offered their forgiveness to the killer, but many have said they're both unable and unwilling to take that step. Are they losing some of their own humanity as a result? The Reverend Walter Brownridge, Dean of the Cathedral of St. Andrew, is a former federal prosecutor as well as a former canon at St. George's Cathedral in Cape Town, South Africa. He's seen the power of forgiveness at first hand, and he joins us by phone this morning. Good morning, Walter.
Hey, good morning, Chris.
Good to talk to you, especially about a subject as fraught as this, because I'm sure you understand the human impulse not to forgive, but what's the problem with that?
Well, the impulse, human impulse is natural to not to forgive.
Yeah.
But I think that spiritually or morally, it is something that we really need to work towards. I don't want to say that we must do it, because that is too easy for me to say. I did not lose anyone in Charleston in my family. I feel a great loss as a human being, as a Christian, as an African American.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say you must forgive so-and-so for what they've done to you.
Right.
But if I have been grievously harmed, I know that for my own spirit, my own soul, as we believe as Christians,
mm-hmm.
that to try to forgive is the only way that we can go forward in life with some sense of wholeness. It is better if the person who's done wrong likewise has taken the responsibility to apologize, to try to make amends and even compensation or reparations for the harm done. But it is essential, as Archbishop Desmond Tutu would say, there is no future without forgiveness. Because if you don't forgive, and that doesn't mean you forget, but if you don't forgive, you are unable to let go of something that it can literally eat away at your psyche, your spirit, your soul, your mind, whatever you care to use as the term.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why... It amazes people. The Charleston example was one. The Amish community several years ago who forgave the man, and he killed himself as well in killing those children in an Amish school.
Mm-hmm.
But the families of the children who died forgave this man and said so to his own surviving family. So those are, or the South African example is another one. Those are examples of how the ability to forgive liberates us to live without something so powerful that can drag us into such despair.
Well, you know, Walter, the South African example has been much on my mind, because it really seemed to me that Mandela, by forgiving his torturers and doing it on a national, institutionalized level, right?
Yes.
By doing so, it's almost as if he was breaking a cycle that had been bedeviling Africa, bedeviling the world since the beginning.
Right, and that is exactly what they said. They wanted to go beyond the cycle of violence and harm, and then you do retribution and revenge, and then the cycle continues, because the party that experiences the quote retribution feels that they are being punished. So, and I mean, that was the result of World War II,
yeah,
which came out of the retribution from World War I. And South Africa used this word, neither Nuremberg, relating to the Nuremberg trials,
right,
of the Nazis, nor amnesia, which often in America, we have what I call a cheap forgiveness or cheap grace, which is, oh, let's just forget about it, let bygones be bygones.
Yeah.
And we refuse to do the hard work of apology, repentance, and forgiveness, and working towards a better future.
Well, that's the whole sort of whatever thing, where you really aren't dealing with something, you're just sort of refusing to think about it. Let's move on.
Exactly. You're refusing to think about it.
And that's what we can't do. And you know, when you feel that impulse, Walter, when you feel that, you know, wrong, violence has been done to you, the first impulse that most people have is to be kind of flooded with evil in terms of, I'm going to do some harm to that person, right?
Exactly. And it eats at you, and you want to do it all the time, and it's risky business, man.
Well, you become your lesser self, it seems to me, Walter.
Exactly. This term avenge, you're trying to avenge something that happened to someone else or to yourself, it is tempting, and it may be naturally human, but at least those of us who talk about theology and matters sort of spirituality, that there is something beyond just the natural. Now, and theologians grapple with this question, though, by saying, are there certain things that are simply unforgivable?
Yeah.
And again, I can't volunteer to say, oh, if this were to happen, it would be unforgivable. If that were to happen, I could forgive it. I think that humanity must at least say, you know, like the Holocaust or what happened with apartheid in South Africa.
Sure.
These are horrible things, but then how do we get to the other side of living as human beings without this continual cycle of vengeance that can plague us?
Well, you know, Walter, maybe in a way, I'm thinking of the line, to forgive is divine, that you are, in a way, you have to sort of transcend the lesser impulses of your own humanity. You're kind of looking for the very best in yourself, in spite of temptation to do otherwise, yeah?
Very true. There's a theologian in there, I think, Chris. Must be all those years of playing the blues. It is the better parts of ourselves are the ones who can, while acknowledging the wrongs that have been done and needing to make recompense of that, we also are able to say, I forgive, because my well-being, my future is dependent upon that as well. So,
and that notion really transcends any one theological doctrine, any specific religious framework. Yeah, that's
exactly.
Just,
yeah, there are many faith traditions and even non-theistic traditions that have used these same concepts and ideas. It's a question for theologians, but also for philosophers, you know, and others.
Probably all of us, Walter. And I thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate getting the
chance. Thank you very much, and allow me to call in from our general convention in Salt Lake City. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. The very Reverend Walter Brownridge is the Dean of the Cathedral of St. Andrew in Honolulu. He served congregations in Ohio, Delaware, New York City, and South Africa. In South Africa, he was a canon at St. George's Cathedral in Cape Town, the mother church of the Anglican community in Southern Africa, And before entering the seminary, Dean Brownridge practiced law for 10 years as a federal prosecutor in the area of public policy.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15, later in the show, a look at the power of mind over matter and the power of yoga to heal. But first, your quiz.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohavaiti.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about one of the six districts of Hawaii Island. This one is on the east side of the island, bordered by South Hilo in the north and Kau in the west. In size, it's slightly smaller than the island of Kauai at 320,000 acres. It's the fastest growing area on the Big Island. In the past 20 years, the population has grown by nearly 20,000 people, and it could have a higher population than Hilo by the year 2020. It's an area that's much affected by the presence of Kilauea volcano. 50 square miles of this district have been covered by lava flows. Some 190 structures have been destroyed because of those flows since 1983. The climate is described as mild tropical one, with plenty of rain, especially in the northern parts and areas of higher elevation. And although rainfall can be very heavy, water is quickly absorbed by the porous volcanic rock in the soil, so flooding is rare. This morning we're looking for the name of this picturesque district, and we'll be back with it in a half hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Good morning. My name is Chief Warrant Officer Michael J. Smith. I'm the officer in charge and principal director for the Marine Forces Pacific Band. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Using yoga with psychology, neuroscience, deep breathing, and mindfulness, Sarah Joy Marsh has just written a book about her journey from the trauma of a serious car accident to her early struggles with an eating disorder, and has become a sought-after teacher of teachers using her methods of natural healing for the body and the mind. Her latest work, Hunger, Hope, and Healing, shares her 26 years of expertise in mastering the art of mindful eating and the increased awareness of using exercises like yoga to help treat those with addiction, anxiety, depression, Parkinson's disease, and more. She's on the line to share more about her methods and talk about how yoga can be an agent for healing and social justice. Sarah Joy, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
You've done yoga for pretty much almost your whole life, is that right?
Well, I've done it for more than half my life. I started when I was 19, and I'm 46 now.
So that's a long time, and you've got a lot of experience. But yoga helped to transform some difficulties you were having in your life. How did that particular form of exercise and activity become such a healing instrument for you?
Well, at 19, I was relatively anxious, felt pretty isolated, overwhelmed with my life, and I discovered what I thought of as stretching, which later became called yoga. And in that discovery, it happened to be in a beautiful place in nature. I experienced my body and my life with a quality of awe that I hadn't prior felt, and I wanted more of that.
Now, this inspired you for the last, boy, over 25 years to not just perfect your technique, but also teach others and use this as a way to transform your life and help others as well. How does that happen? How did you wind up making this your mission and your passion in life?
Well, I really did feel quite isolated before I discovered the practices that are now called stretching, breathing, mindfulness, meditation, and yoga. And because it transformed my life so powerfully to experience something other than isolation and anxiety, I really felt compelled to share it with other people. And I was doing this at a time in which I had a lot of naivete about how to do that, so I also had a lot of courage and confidence. And I basically just stepped into the opportunities that were available to me, starting in prisons and rehab centers and mental health centers and moving into private practice for people with anxiety and addiction.
I love the idea that courage and confidence, that you started out sort of saying, I don't know, but I'm going to try it. I'm going to give this a really good, you know, college try and see how it goes. And it's taken you so far. Tell us about this book, Hunger, Hope, and Healing, because it seems like it's actually incorporating not just yoga, but also this description of what you call the 360-degree life.
Yeah, which I think of yoga as giving us the gateway to what's called this 360-degree life. And that basically means that most of us live in a more narrow, confined way than we realize we're doing. We might have 40 or 50 degrees on board of who we are, who we think we can become, what we think we can do or accomplish, how we can feel, how we can see ourselves. And yoga slowly widens that out to be a circumference that's 360 degrees. Means you get to be your whole self, and it's not predetermined. It gets to keep unfolding and evolving. Yoga helps with that because of how it does make each of us more courageous and more confident, and we also come to life in ways that we hadn't prior been able to.
Now, you've had a lot of people that you've taught, you've trained, you've worked with over the years. Do you have a particular person whose success is just, you know, something that you think embodies what you've been trying to work on?
Yeah, I have several people. I'll just give you two quick anecdotes. One is the woman, this is a compilation of a woman who'd come to see me, has been bulimic for 20 or 30 years and hasn't had anything be particularly effective in derailing that. And when she took up the practices of yoga and met me as her primary therapist, she started making commitments in small steps and was able to radically overcome bulimic habits and tendencies. That was very inspiring to me, as well as the inmates with whom I've been lucky to work with for the last 17 years. Seeing them get out of prison and move into a yoga community and become yoga teachers themselves has been also really awe-inspiring.
Now, in addition to being a yoga expert, you also have a master's in counseling. It sounds like you sort of combine those aspects of therapy along with physical movement and sort of fuse those into a way that people can really use their body to help heal themselves.
I did, yeah. And putting together art therapy, which is my master's in counseling, is in art therapy and yoga therapy. Putting those two things together, I just felt like this is the ideal way to teach people life skills that they might have missed out on, which is why we have self-harming behaviors or addictions or anxiety issues. Like, they could learn life skills through their body and through the dialogue that they have with me and start to uncover a life that's more powerful and more sustainable. 'Cause self-harm and addiction and anxiety aren't very sustainable ways to live.
Now, you've taken this from a practice that you started when you were 19, and fast forward almost 30 years, and now this is a practice that you're sharing with others. What's up next for you?
Well, I'm training clinical psychologists and social workers to integrate yoga therapy into their practices, and I'm training yoga therapists on how to integrate mental health tools into what they do. And that's a really exciting horizon. We're breaking ground, including being acknowledged by the American Psychological Association, which is relatively difficult to get into. And we're breaking ground in yoga therapy here in the Northwest of the states, because we're getting into hospitals, rehab centers, school systems. That's all, for me, a very exciting horizon to build community around. And I just feel very fortunate to be in the position that I'm in. I'm opening doors for students and for practitioners and providers.
Well, it certainly sounds exciting, and I hope to hear more about it, and we'll have to talk about it as some of these doors open. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
The book Hunger, Hope, and Healing, A Yoga Approach to Reclaiming Your Relationship to Your Body and Food and Life is available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and at sarahjoyyoga.com. More information on our website, HPR2.
Got to get in to get out, way out. Six scientists try to discover what it's like out on the red planet Mars by getting inside a dome on a dormant volcano for 8 months. The cold, isolation, and terrain 8,000 feet up on the Hawaiian peak of Mauna Loa would make a Martian feel right at home. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
Hawaii has long been thought of as an ideal location for biotechnology companies. They came here to take advantage of a year-long growing season. But these days, companies like DuPont Pioneer and Syngenta Kauai have begun to lay off workers, return leased land to the state, and lose annual revenue. What's behind all this? Chad Blair has more from Civil Beat. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
These companies have seen a downturn in annual revenue, and they're kind of citing worldwide market forces, yeah?
Exactly. So this is Anita Hofschneider's story, and she traveled to Kekaha on Kauai's west side, mm-hmm. where Pioneer shut down that facility in March, and folks are definitely struggling there. She talked to one shop owner, for example, who said she's seen more customers with food stamps. Now, you might think it has something to do with, if you will, the ground zero battle over GMO and pesticides that has been going on in Hawaii, right? There's the ban on the GMO in the Big Island, moratorium. Yeah, the moratorium on Maui.
Right.
And disclosure of pesticide use in Kauai, and a lot of that stuff is tied up in lawsuits. But in fact, it's really global market trends that have led to cost cutting on the part of these seed companies.
Well, but you can hardly rule out the fact that they're operating in a very different atmosphere than they thought they were going to be operating in 5-10 years ago, right?
No question. And Anita talked to ag experts in Iowa and California. One of them said that Hawaii does not have a reputation for being innovative when it comes to agriculture, and certainly what happened on the neighbor islands got a lot of attention. But you know, the reality is that the seed industry here, the seed crop industry in Hawaii, it was a $243 million business back in 2012. Just 2 years later, dropped to $159 million. That's a big drop. And the number of acres that were harvested dropped by 30%. So you can see why companies are having to lay people off and look at returning that GMO land to the state or whoever they got it from.
And, of course, the underlying story is the economic effect on people in Hawaii, right?
Absolutely. One positive outcome, environmentalists are happy that maybe some of those lands that have been used for GMO production could actually go into organic farming. And so there may be an upside out of all of this. By the way, it is a cyclical business, and we could see that changing soon, as well as possibly some resolution in those lawsuits on the Big Island, Maui, and Kauai.
It's also kind of a reminder that, you know, with anything like this, there are jobs involved, there are people involved, and the human impact in terms of the GMO controversy doesn't always get cited, it seems.
Exactly, and I think that's another takeaway, a reality check, if you will, from Anita's story, is that these are people. They are definitely affected. So when we read headlines about GMO lawsuits and seed crop industry and so forth, we don't always realize that actually people are employed in this industry, and related to that, it's going to affect the economy. It's going to affect people's lives, being able to pay their rent and buy food.
Well, we'll keep watch on that. I know you folks will too. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Good morning. I'm Adair from Art Truck Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. What's on the agenda today? I always learn something when I hear your show. What can we look forward to?
Hey, Kathy, we're going to be talking about podcasting. Are you familiar with podcasting?
You know, I am. I can't say I do it, but podcasting is something that really does allow people to listen to stuff even after it's gone live. It's a great way to communicate.
Well, you know, the thing that's interesting is, podcasting has been around for many years. I mean, probably back in, 2008 or so, the idea of putting up an audio recording of what you perhaps have done as a solo or maybe a duo and just talking story. And then there's this thing called an MP3, right? And then, of course, you have blogs and you can have a subscription. And then these audio files became a regular thing that people would create just like a radio show. Well, so we're talking 2008, we're 7 years down the road, and all of a sudden there's like this resurgence of interest in podcasting to the extent where, full-on companies are getting venture capital investment to create their podcast. And so we'll talk a little bit about, how has the sort of industry, the environment, the people evolved over this period of time, and going to delve into a couple of local podcasters that have been around and have seen this sort of industry evolve and, sort of get their insights.
Well, the best news is that we also have podcasts. And so if you don't have a chance to listen, although I hope you do, on live, you can also listen to our podcast, Bert.
That's right.
You can hear
That's
it,
right.
HawaiiPublicRadio.org. So, well, I'm going to listen to you live. So
okay, good. We'll talk about podcasting and of course, the president was on a podcast recently. He was on with a podcast. You can look at the Twitter account, WTFPOD. He was on there.
All right, all from the top on down. That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5.
Cane burning continues on Maui with State Department of Health approval, but community opposition continues as well. A group called StopCaneBurning.org is asking a number of community voices to make themselves heard at a forum in Kihei tomorrow evening. One of them is Dr. Lauren Pang, the Department of Health's District Health Officer for Maui County. He'll be speaking as a private citizen, looking at the science behind the health concerns, and he's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Dr. Pang.
Good morning. I speak as a private citizen now.
Understood, yes. What kind of information is out there about cane burning?
Well, the Department of Health has required a lot of specific data every time they burn. Mm-hmm. We know the amount they burn, the wind directions, the location of the site.
Mm-hmm.
But to piece it all together, a lot of people has addressed, regardless of the existing rules for burning or not burning, are there still lingering health effects from the burning?
Mm-hmm.
Classically, this was almost an impossible question to answer because of the VOG effect. They are not allowed to burn when there's VOG.
Hmm.
So if you do the classic study, how much symptoms are coming in the hospital or the pharmacies, when you burn versus don't burn, you will see there's more symptoms when you don't burn because those are the VOG days. Okay? So this could not be studied. But we kind of devised a method to get around all of this, and the paper has been submitted for publication. I cannot give you specifics, but I can give you enough findings because we already said this to the public in previous meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typically, we were monitoring the hospital and the pharmacies for symptoms of respiratory symptoms,
right,
of smoke.
Mm-hmm.
forward. It is true, and we showed exactly what they suspected. When you don't burn, there's a whole lot more symptoms because of VOG. And if you say, well, why don't you just avoid the VOG days? They publish out of the Big Island, when there's VOG, the effects of the symptoms can last up to a week. So just because you don't see VOG that day doesn't mean there's not a VOG effect. Now, in order to get around this, that's what the classic way of doing it is. We needed the GPS satellite monitoring. We needed exactly what the Department of Health had been collecting, the amount burned, the wind directions, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And we simply look at downwind versus upwind or not downwind when you burn. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of logical. If you're going to burn, you would expect more symptoms downwind than upwind. Compared to what?
Yeah.
Compared to when you don't burn. So even if there's more VOG and there's more symptoms downwind, upwind, the ratio is different. And we tallied this over many days, 55 burn days, and we looked at to see if there was an effect. And there's a beautiful dose response. Remember, they tally the amount you burn? The more you burn, the more downwind effect you see.
Right.
And there is a threshold above which you cross that the statisticians say statistically significant. Yeah, it is. And it's quite a rise in the symptoms. So we think we have found a threshold. I can't give you actual specifics because it'll jeopardize the scientific publication.
But you can be quite specific about effects. It sounds as if you can be specific in ways that we haven't been able to be specific before. Is that accurate?
Yes, and I've given it to people to keep confidential to see if they want to input into their criteria. Now, this is like theoretical and it's not published yet, but I can tell you, since the study was completed and submitted for publication, the month of May was a very interesting month. They burned 17 days out of the month of May.
Right.
And one day on the 27th of May was horrific. The amount of pictures and the complaints, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
We blindly looked at the amount burned each day for those 17 days of burning. And it's very interesting. The one day they exceeded our threshold that we published
was May 27th.
Exactly that day on the 27th.
Well, there's a photograph online of Pilani Highway on May 27th, and you can't see the horizon. It's everything is grayed out. So, you know, Dr. Pang, you've been talking about the problems of a scientific study and deciding what comes from where. At the same time, anecdotally, especially when you look at a picture like this, a lot of people on Maui don't know from the scientific information. They know what they see and what they breathe. You're going to be hearing a lot of that, right?
Yes, but in the past, we have always taken these complaints with a little grain of salt. A lot of times people complain, like you might complain, hey, can you see the picture?
Yeah.
But did you get sick? A lot of times people might get sick but not go to the emergency room or the pharmacy, the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times we discount people when they say, I see this smoke. We have to say, were you in the smoke? Did you get sick or not?
Yeah.
So once again, it is true. When you monitor the pharmacy's hospital, you look at the tip of the iceberg. But you know, in our study, we saw what you expect to see, a dose response and the cutoff level. I would ask maybe they could green harvest. They're going to burn so much, or they can split the burn on different days or something. Maybe they can, maybe they can't.
Yeah. It sounds as if a big part of the problem in the past and a continuing part of the problem is simply aggregating accurate information and being able to pinpoint.
We have very accurate information, but nobody knew what to do with it. Because point blank, if you look at the non-burn days, there's more symptoms because VOG, they're not allowed to burn on the VOG days.
Uh-huh.
So that kind of ruins any attempt at a study.
Yeah.
Until we've got the GPS mapping.
Well, that's the issue of what comes from where.
No, actually, what comes from where, if you just check downwind of the burn, you're looking at the burn effects.
Right.
That's correct. But if you overlay on that a general VOG effect, you can still see a higher ratio in the downwind area. You kind of know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little complicated, but I can't tell you on the phone. We don't have the time, and it'll jeopardize the publication. But, you know, I mean,
well,
I owe it to the students. They're from the UH School of Pharmacy and
But Dr. Peng, you're able to speak to, in a general way, to what the findings are and the direction in which the findings point, right?
Yes. There is also a piece of work coming out of the University of Hawaii. They did a mathematical modeling of the effects of fog across all the islands. If you look carefully, you will see a spike in Maui. You say, hey, what's that spike? I thought it was cane burning. It was a bad day of a forest fire. So where is the cane burning effect in that fog analysis? I'm not sure, but it was sensitive enough to pick reports of symptoms from a bad brush fire day.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, other people are looking at this, too, in a different way.
Well, we'll see what, you know, obviously a great deal remains to be discussed about this. And thank you very much for taking the time, Dr. Peng.
You're welcome.
Lauren Peng, MD, is a State Department of Health's District Health Officer for Maui County. As he made clear, he's speaking as a private citizen in today's conversation. He'll be speaking as a forum on the cane burning issue tomorrow evening at the Kihei Community Center. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Aloha, I'm Marla Momi Music, owner and designer of Pacificology. You're tuned to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about one of Hawaii Island's six districts. This one takes up about 500 square miles, roughly the same size as Kauai. There's a wide range of climate zones to be found here, ranging from rainforest to desert shrub and coastal strand. There's much to see here, including lava flows from Kilauea Volcano, the Star of the Sea Painted Church, several spectacular steam vents, and large areas of native forest. The Kapoho Tide Pools offer some of the best snorkeling on Hawaii Island, and Mackenzie Park offers plenty of shade from its ironwood trees and beautiful views of the ocean from a coastal cliff. The climate makes it a perfect place to grow things, and local farms have an abundance of tropical fruits and flowers, including papaya, citrus, orchids, anthuriums, gingers, heliconias, and birds of paradise. Many of the people who live here will tell you they wouldn't live anywhere else. And by now, you may have guessed, we're talking about the Puna District.
And Jeremy Wagner didn't have to guess because he knew the answer. Jeremy Wagner of Manoa is the winner. He'll be getting an HPR T-shirt. Nice going. And at 8:47, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
From the Mississippi Delta to Chicago's South Side, Rick Smith and his band, the Trailer Park Romeos, is going to take us on a blues pilgrimage this weekend at the Atherton. But first, we have him here in the studio to give us a little sneak peek of his musical technique and soon enough jam with our very own Chris Vandercook live. Welcome, Rick.
Oh, good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. Tell me about the blues. There's a subset. The preacher blues.
Oh,
where
yeah.
did all this take root?
Well, for me, I kind of stumbled onto it by reading about the old blues guys that performed before World War II, country blues musicians way down in the South. And some of them were actually preachers, you know, and but they were also blues men, and they would either write their own songs or take hymnals or gospel songs and put it to a blues format, and they would sing, you know, and a lot of these blind, a lot of these guys that were blind couldn't work out in the cotton fields. They would busk and panhandle with their guitar on street corners, and they didn't just play blues, they played gospel and hymnals so that people would give them more, you know, more money and stuff, and that's how they made their living. Fred McDowell was a sharecropper, you know, Mississippi Fred McDowell, but he was also a blues man. He made many albums, but he wrote, he performed hymnals and stuff. So, yeah, I call it the preaching blues, and it's kind of an interesting sub-genus of the blues, and we're going to be doing a couple of these types of blues Saturday. Me and my good friend Joe Green, in the first half, I'm going to be playing a lot of old-time stuff, and then in the second half, it'll be kind of like Chicago blues, you know, the old blues meets the amplifier and meets the electric guitar, and that's what happened in the 50s.
So it's a unique mesh of really following the blues from where they started in Mississippi all the way up to Chicago's South Side, and really just giving us a good example of where that tradition went and how the how the sound traveled and maybe changed a little bit and took on a little Chicago spin.
Right, it evolved. It evolved, and by the time it got up to the 50s and the cities up north and stuff, those blues men did it a certain way that basically went out and conquered the world as other young musicians from Britain and here in America heard this, and they started doing their own type of blues and stuff.
Helping it travel around the world. Well, I see your beautiful guitar. Let's hear a little sample of what people may hear this weekend. And Chris, you're going to play along with them. Live music in the studio. What more could you ask for?
I've got a yearning heart, girl, but I believe my time ain't long. I got a yearning heart, girl. Oh, but I believe my time ain't long. I think about you, girl, and that's why I sing. Example.
We got a nice live preview of what people might hear. Now, tell me a little bit about your guitar. It's a very unique instrument in appearance, and it gives you a slightly different sound. What's the difference, and where does it come from?
Well, these type of guitars are called resonators. The one I have is a cherry wood. You know, it's like a regular guitar, but it has a big old metal pan in the middle of it that gives it a different sound, and was designed to make it a little bit louder than a normal guitar. Now, you also see resonators that are all steel, and they sound a little more metallic than this one. I will have a lot of different guitars this Saturday, and people will be able to hear the different sounds from electric guitars and to the resonators and other different kinds of guitars. It's all blues.
It's all part of the plan. Now, tell me a little bit about the idea of a slide guitar. You have a device on your pinky. What does that do, and how does that change the sound a little?
Well, I'm glad that you asked that. The original intention of these old blues guys, they wanted to try and imitate violins. This is what I've read. But they had to tune the guitars. Now, believe it or not, there was this attraction. A lot of the early recorded guitar music was Hawaiian music in the 30s. It was very, very popular, the slack key tuning of the guitars of the original Paniolo songs and stuff. And the blues men, you know, the southern guys, African Americans down south, tried to imitate this, but they'd wear a bottleneck or a piece of metal to slide, or a pocket knife to slide on the strings and stuff, and accompany themselves while they sang their blues. And the slide guitar, if you could master that, because it's hard, it took me a long time, if you could master it and sing and keep the tone in pitch, the note on the guitar, then you have, you know, W.C. Handy first heard it, and it blew his mind in a little train station in Mississippi late one night. And he ended up being attracted to this kind of country folk music, he called it. And then he published it, and the rest is history.
Well, and if you want to see history, you want to see these unique guitars, you want to watch the slide in action, there's only one place that's going to happen. You can see Rick Smith and his group this Saturday night at the Atherton. He'll be with the Trailer Park Romeos and a special guest, Joe Green. Tickets are available. You can take a look at our website, hpr2.org. Thanks for coming in with the live music, Rick.
Oh, thank you so much, Kathy and Chris. Y'all have a good week. All right, bye-bye.
You too.
A little dip in the morning always helped me keep my head on right. Slipping in just as the day is dawning makes me happy, makes me feel alright.
On the next Fresh Air, we hear about a program in the Watts community in L.A. where former gang members and drug dealers work on becoming better fathers.
We just have standing room only now. You know, it's something that they said wasn't going to work.
We talk with Mike Cummings, a former gang member, now a pastor and co-leader of the group, and social welfare professor Georgia Leap, author of the new book Project Fatherhood. Join us.
Here, Fresh Air, this afternoon at 3.
Kathy, that's a great American music tradition, the itinerant blues artist going from town to town with his guitar, telling his story. And Rick is kind of evokes that in his music, I think.
He does, but, you know, there you are. You're going from studio and show to show, bringing your guitar and just kind of jamming right on in there with him.
Well, it's been a big part of both our lives. It's good to hear him today. And that's it for today. Up tomorrow.
Why can't I bring it back? The latest Department of Agriculture campaign to help preserve our native plants and animals by not letting people sneak in seemingly harmless gifts from their trips abroad. And it's time to get our groove on with the International Reggae Festival right here in the islands.
We like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want to pass one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links for more information about guests and topics are there, too. I'm Kathy Kozak.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Meet us in the morning for more of The Conversation.